about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Nick Conklin and Collins Illich, and they'll be answering your questions on fly fishing pressured waters. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Nick or Collins a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show as possible tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share a podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're listening to the show. That would be wonderful. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted as the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as AskAboutFlyFishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Nick Conklin and Collins Illich about fly fishing pressured waters. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Nick and Collins, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Nick and Collins' book, Fly Fishing Pressured Waters, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And to learn more about Stackpole Books, you can go to stackpolebooks.com and look at all the books that they publish there, which are many. And we've also got a link on the homepage of our website to Nick and Collins' book, Fly Fishing Pressured Waters, so you can buy a copy there if you don't win this copy tonight. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that that Nick and Collins and I talk about during the show, and you must submit it using with your answer using your name and location, using that text box on our homepage, okay? So listen closely and use your best typing skills. Take some notes, and maybe you'll be the proud winner of Fly Fishing Pressured Waters. Tonight, our guests are Nick Conklin and Collins Illich. Nick is the fly fishing product manager for Temple Fork Outfitters. He also coordinates the trade and consumer shows at Temple Fork Outfitters and is a popular presenter at the fly fishing shows. He is the chair of the board of the American Fly Fishing Trade Association and is a published freelance author for national newspapers and magazines such as Field & Stream, Outdoor Life, The Drake, the Fort Worth Star Telegram, and the Lone Star Outdoor News. Collins is the vice president of Sawgrass Rods, a USCG master captain. He also operates a guide operation based in northern Texas with an emphasis on trophy, smallmouth, and freshwater striper. Collins has hosted trips and guided on six continents. He interacts with thousands of anglers annually at trade shows, on the water, and through professional social media management. Nick and Collins, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, thanks a lot for having us, Roger. We're excited to be here.
Well, good to have you. Good to have you. And this will be fun. This is a topic that we've never covered. I mean, I'm almost at 20 years. In March, I'll be 20 years doing this, and we've never talked about pressured waters. And they've become more pressured in the past 20 years, I think. So good topic to cover tonight. And I'm looking forward to your answers to a lot of these great questions we have. So let's get started. First of all, you know, how do you define pressured water? And, you know, what are the earliest signs for anglers that they should recognize to observe, you know, that these are pressured waters?
Well, this is Collins, and I would say that's a difficult thing to define, and it's because, you know, there's not a census test as to X, Y, or Z relative to fish population, angler population. And, you know, I grew up fishing some small water, and just over the course of my life, I saw more and more and more people fish that. And if you fished a certain body of water and you used to see 5 anglers on it, and now you see 25 anglers on it, that's going to feel like pressured water to you. Whereas if you fish a really, really popular body of water that could have hundreds or thousands of anglers during a day, and then that doubles over time, you know, that's going to feel like pressure to you. So it's relative to the individual and to the body of water, in my opinion. It's not a black and white statement, but it speaks to the fact that just more people are fishing, it's easier to find new water or undiscovered water, quote unquote, and water is, it's just more anglers are fishing. What do you think?
And not just more anglers fishing, it's also environmental pressures, right? So yeah. I think the pressure is hitting you from two sides, just the amount of people wading or floating down the river, but also everything that's going on environmentally, low water, high water, warm water, cold water. There's a lot of other pressures that may not be as apparent if you just don't see anybody else standing next to you on the river. So I think it comes from both sides.
Yeah, I suppose in a stretch of water on a low water, hot day, two anglers could be high pressure for that piece of water, right? And then, you know, another day with better conditions, it might support 5 anglers, right? So, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I remember when I was a kid, I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska. My dad and I used to go to this place that was about 45 minutes from Anchorage called Bird Creek. And we used to be the only two people fishing in a mile-long stretch. Then we went back years later, and I mean many years later, and went down there because we had a layover in Anchorage, and we went there to fish again. And it was shoulder to shoulder. People were waiting in line to get for somebody to step out so they could step in. And we all shook our heads and walked away. To me, that was pressured water. And part of it was just the highway got paved to Alaska, which changed everything. So that was kind of an environment.
That speaks exactly to both those points, right? Is that it's
right.
All relative, and it's also environmental circumstantial pressure.
Yeah, a lot of different things going on. You know, you basically, I think, you know, we're focusing on Western rivers with your book. And yeah, we need to highlight that. Collins and Nick just published Fly Fishing for Pressured Waters, and it's a great book, and they did a wonderful job. And we were just talking before the show. I used to be a commercial photographer, and they didn't know that, but I was giving them compliments on all the photography in there. So kudos to these two gentlemen for putting out a great book about pressured water. So how have you seen it change in the last decade or so in Western waters?
So there's been a lot of changes. I mean, a decade is a large amount of time. And in the first chapter or so, first few paragraphs, we talk about really just what we call the southern, the southeastern migration of people, COVID and, you know, quickly post-COVID, how many people are traveling up there to fish, buying second or third homes. So there's been a lot of migration to people spending more and more time on rivers in the northern and southern Rockies. So, yes, it's been happening for a long time, but you look at license sales and a lot of other factors, the last few years have put a lot of pressure and a lot of focus on some of those western rivers.
Yeah, during COVID, I think in Colorado, I think they sold, I think it was 70,000 licenses more than normal during COVID for that year, which is an incredible amount. I'm sure not all of those have continued to fish, but that was something you could do during COVID that was enjoyable, right? So, yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, a huge migration of people fishing, buying licenses, and, you know, it's one of those kind of tricky, tight lines to to toe, and we talk about it often, is you spend time in some of these smaller mountain towns or more fishy, quote-unquote, towns, and yes, it's important. You want to help the local economy. You want businesses to be successful. You want guides to be booking trips and making money and shops to be selling things, but you also have to weigh how much pressure is too much on the rivers and the local fishing resources, and it's a tough challenge, and I think we both can agree a lot of these were pushed to the max during and shortly after the COVID period. It's something all anglers have to be considerate of and figure out what is, you know, what works and what doesn't work and how much they're pushing it.
But I would like to say that with all that gathered up, both y'all's comments, I came away with 2 points. One, like, it was more than a decade, let's say 20 years ago, when you first started the podcast, it would have been a lot harder to find certain mountain towns, you know, and that goes back to that environmental outside pressure, because now I can sit on my computer and find hidden gems all over the country that I can drive mm-hmm. a two-wheel drive truck to. And then second, though the book is titled, you know, it's all about fly fishing pressured waters, and we talk about all of the pressures that we keep bringing up throughout this discussion, we firmly believe that the fisheries can sustain themselves if we're responsible and reasonable about how we approach it and how we handle it. Like, our fisheries are amazing. There's amazing fisheries from the Southeast to the Pacific Northwest all over, and everybody can have a great time fishing if we're respectful of each other and respectful of the resource.
Yeah, it's, you know, this kind of subject has come up a lot in some of my prior shows. And it's, you know, what I always come back to is we just keep having more and more people and we don't have any more water. And that to me is a big problem. I know, and I'm going to wait till the end of the show to get your guys' feedback on this, but I know, you know, like in Europe, there's a lot of, like a pay to play in many places in Europe. I mean, if you want to fish because of the number of people and the limited waters, you know, you got to pay to play. And, I'm just thinking, having done a lot of whitewater rafting here in the West, that's what that's become. Sometimes you wait years to get permits now to run a river if you want to do it yourself without a guide. And I'm just wondering if that will be that way for fishing. I mean, we just talk about this now. Forget the end of the show since I brought it up. But you know what I'm saying is, like, is it going to become a more privatized and pay-to-play sport because of the pressure to preserve the fisheries, as you've just talked about?
It doesn't have to, and I think there's a lot of really good work being done in some species that aren't or don't have that iconic, you know, idea, like a trout or like a steelhead or a salmon. I mean, there's some great books being written, a lot of good work being done with things like carp, largemouth bass, striped bass, hybrid bass. So if people are creative and are willing to try something different, I think we could hold off that pay to play. You know, unfortunately, mm-hmm. that is a reality of some of it. But
part of the thesis of our book is, in fact, that we acknowledge pay to play exists. Like, there's, but the book is written for public water anglers. And, and I don't think either of us as anglers or either of us as guys that make our livelihood selling fishing rods would be terribly excited if we evolved into a European beat style system of fishing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what, I think there's a really clear path forward for us to avoid that, I think. And that,
good.
I mean,
that started with
the foundation of the National Park Service. And
yeah, thank goodness for that, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, see, and that's the other, access, each state has different water access policies, and that's affecting public access and limiting it in many ways too. You know, we've got a very restrictive policy here in Colorado, and Wyoming does. Montana is a little bit better. But yeah, a lot of that plays a role too, I think, in what we as the public can access, for sure.
Yep.
I know yeah, go ahead.
I say that access is an interesting thing. Again, you talk about too many people showing up and fishing a body of water, but to me there's an element of, if people don't know about it, people don't fish it, they don't get to learn to love it, and they don't care about it. So when those access conversations and that legislation comes up, right, you want more people to be aware of it and have deep passion and care about it. So it's
And I think you could specifically look at the 1980s Texas redfish situation, where redfish was commercially harvested basically to, from at least a fishery standpoint, extinction, not species standpoint, but fishery standpoint. And because of sport fishing and the influence that sport fishing had, and specifically if you want to cite CCA, getting sport fish designation for redfish saved that fishery, developed that fishery. And there are more anglers fishing that water now than there were in the 80s, but it's a much better fishery than it was, circling back to proper planning, proper access.
Yeah, and same thing like down in Belize where, you know, permit tarpon and bonefish are all protected fishes now, and they were just fishing the, you know, the hell out of them down there. Yeah, yeah. And I remember back in the 70s and stuff, it was like, you know, in the restaurants, the popular dish was blackened redfish everywhere, you know. And I think that's when they were really being fished heavily commercially back then. But anyway, yeah, good. So let's take a little break here first, and then we're going to talk more about a section of your book. So give me just 30 seconds, and we'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com, or you can call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com, or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Nick Conklin and Collins Illich about fly fishing pressured waters. If you'd like to ask Nick or Collins a question, just go to our homepage and fill out that Q&A text box and send us your question. Let's talk a bit about the second chapter of your book. You titled it Time Management. Can you share with us some of the things that we should be concerned about in relationship to that? I thought when I first saw the title of that chapter, it was like, what's that about? So can you kind of enlighten us on what your thinking was there?
Yes, and you'll get throughout the book, several of the titles and a lot of the lines have a good basis in music and film history. But time management's an important one, and one that we spend a lot of time just watching other anglers, and that time management element starts well before you hit the water, in our opinion. It's how you organize your gear, how you reset after fishing trips or after full seasons. And, you know, one of the, or at least two of the more troubling things we often see, and everyone doesn't, we're just as guilty as anybody is, you see somebody standing in the river trying to fumble around and tie a new leader, tie new flies on, or if they're fishing and their casting isn't quite where it should be before they hit the river, they're spending a lot of time trying to carry line, trying to haul, trying to put the fly in the water. And anytime the fly's not in the water, right, what's the point? You're not going to catch fish outside of the river. So we talked a lot about time management because there's a lot of elements to that that you could really mitigate a lot of time spent, again, without the fly in the water, to put it simply.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to fish, we talk about half days, full days all the time, right, when we're talking about whether we're planning with our friends, our wives, or guides. But be honest, like most of the time, if you got 5 good solid hours of fishing a day, you're doing pretty well. At least me with 3 kids, I'm doing pretty well if I can do that. And if I, the night before, if instead of, you know, having a couple extra beers and staying up late with my friends, I got all my gear properly rigged, had a plan in place, and was ready to go when I got to the river, I mean, that could be an extra 20% of fishing time or 10% of fishing time. And that's a measurable quantity of time. And it's usually going to be some of the premier time that you're on the water, too. You're sacrificing the best time to get organized and to get your head in the game.
And so relate that to pressured waters. What's the relationship there?
I would say some of that relationship comes down to everyone does what we call the boat ramp dance or the coffee top dance, right? most other anglers are going to get up and take their time to get out there. And there's advantages on certain bodies of water, certain times of year, to get out there early or stay out there mm-hmm. a little bit later. So if you could just be thoughtful and think about what everybody else is doing, right? And again, we call it the boat ramp dance, talking about fishing with a guide or fishing with somebody in a boat. And that's reasonable time that adds up if you're just standing there, if your plan isn't clear, you haven't communicated well, if your tackle, your gear is not rigged up, you're not ready to go. And then you spend the first 50, 100, almost 200 yards floating down the river before you have, you know, some flies in the water, you get your cast together. So there's a lot of opportunities if you can show up prepared, if you have a good clear plan, if communication's clear, and you're ready to go.
I would add to that a compliment to you, which is I appreciate, and I mean this genuinely, how literally you read the book, because you clearly did. And there are things in our book that transcend just pressured fishing. Even if you were the trust fund kiddo that we talked about a few minutes ago, to where you had access to the Longhorn Ranch your whole life and could fish, you know, the most iconic Spring Creek water exclusively any day you wanted on the given day. Regardless, the techniques discussed, and this one in particular, throughout the book, apply to all types of fishing. You know, regardless of how exclusive the water is or how public the water is or how many anglers are on the water, if you show up prepared, both mentally, physically, and equipment-wise, you will have a better day, period. And we, as professional anglers, and we as recreational anglers, and we as authors, have watched a lot of people show up, you know, with their reel on backwards, or they forgot their reel. Okay. My reel on the Elk River this year, so it's, I can't say, you know, I mean, just because we say it doesn't mean we always do it, right? But if you yeah. show up prepared and you're ready, you will have a better day fishing, regardless of how much pressure is or isn't on that water.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, yeah, what I'm hearing is because the water is pressured and we may have limited time and access, you're better off being prepared so that you get the most out of the time you do have with that special
yes, sir.
Resource.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I've done that. I've personally done the boat ramp dance. I mean, I
we all have.
But it goes back, usually, you know, when I'm with a guide, it's not an issue, because if the guide's any good at all, he's going to be all rigged up with everything before he ever gets close to that ramp. And when you go in, you're gone, you know, and you got your line in. But then other people that have their own boats, you know, dilly-dally around, or my last experience in Colorado was not knowing the boat ramp. And when we pulled down there, it was like, oh, you got to put your boat in right away. I mean, there was no alternative. We should have scouted the ramp before we pulled the boat down there, which we didn't. And consequently, we joined three other boats all tied up to the bank just south of the ramp there, getting rigged up. And we just weren't ready to put the boat in, but conditions were that we had to. So,
well,
again,
hey, that's a great way to meet new friends. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's one way to meet them. Yeah. But the good thing is, while I was rigging up, my son started casting from the shore because he was ready and caught the first fish and went about three casts at the boat ramp. So there you go, you know? All those fish that were missed right at the boat ramp, right? Yeah.
From, like, a true pragmatic fishing perspective on this chapter, you just quantified it perfectly, because – Nick and I have, and Nick is a much more skilled angler than I am at this point, and I'm older than Nick, so it's a bit disappointing in my life. But we have, with regularity, sat at boat ramps, watched people do what Chapter 2 talks about, ill-preparedness, and it goes, we don't want to just talk about it on a boat ramp perspective, but it applies to wading anglers too, right? So somebody shows up, they hit the water that they intend to hit, and they're not prepared, and you can walk right behind them and catch fish, because there's a reason most boat ramps are where they are, and we've done it. Those fish, they're there, they're eager, they're willing to. There's usually some really, really nice, generally man-made obstacle that's going to be fish holding water, and if you're ready and you're prepared, you're going to catch fish right there, just like your son did. And if you're not, you're going to float right by it.
Yeah. And, you know, I hear you, too, on, you know, the wading fish. If a guy wades out, first of all, he wades right out in the water, and then he spends the next 20 minutes tying his fly on, he's kind of wasting that resource, just like the boat ramp situation, right? Taking up space, nobody's fishing that water, there's limited access, and if he was prepared, then he'd be making better use of it. I keep saying he, but he, she, and I apologize for that, ladies.
May I add one thing to your previous statement there?
Sure.
Which is, I mean, I'm 45, and that was a joke. Like, Nick is an excellent angler, but that was a joke about my age earlier. But I only have so much time in a day that I can stand. I fish the Madison River. That's my home trout river. And there's only so many hours I can physically stand in the Madison a day before I get tired and it's unsafe for me to wade. If I wade out there and I spend 20 minutes getting ready to go fishing, I've lost those 20 minutes of fishing. I can't get those back. That is a straight net loss. That make any sense?
Yeah, sure.
That's a physiology. Yeah. You know?
And when you get even older, like me, it's more advantageous to get a guide to tie those flies on and rig you up than it is for me to do it anymore. You know, I used to give my dad a little grief about when he was struggling to tie on his flies because he was having trouble seeing, you know. And, you know, we used to joke about it. And he goes, you wait. Well, I'm there now. So I'm getting paid back for those comments to my dad. Let's put it that way. Yeah. So,
I know we have, I have to tell you a one-minute story real quickly. I apologize.
Sure.
It's totally unrelated to the book. But in the evenings, during the summer, I take my youngest son fishing quite often. And I never wore glasses, never had a problem, could thread a fly, first try every time. And this is how fast it happens for you young anglers out there. We were fishing, we broke off, and I could not thread the next fly. That's how fast my eyes went this summer, and I just had to get glasses from that moment on. It was, I tied a fly on, we went down to the river, and I could not do it. And literally, a boat rode by us and couldn't see us because of where we were. And they were very alarmed because they did row into our water, but it wasn't their fault. And I actually asked the guide, I was like, man, would you just tie this fly on for me? I physically could not do it. So it happens fast, and it happens to all of us.
Yeah, yeah, it does. And it doesn't get better. It just gets worse. But anyway, patience. For loss, for all the things we lose, we have to gain more patience. That's the key. Yeah. We joke at times that we all, you know, when we talk about pressured areas and so forth is, you know, just walk 100 yards up or downstream and you'll be all alone. So why don't we talk about that for a minute? You know, when and where should we fish to avoid highly pressured waters, or how do we get around the pressured areas in that regard?
I think one of the first steps is just observing other people. You know, we fixate so much as a culture on what people are wearing, what they're doing, but we really retain it, right? And there's a lot of times we sit and watch people like, oh, I have to hike 2 miles downriver to find fishable water. Okay, maybe that's a good option, but how many other people are thinking in that same sense? So cycling back to what we just said on the boat ramp, now people think, oh, there's people loading and unloading boats. There's parking lot right here. This is the obvious water, so let's go further. Well, maybe consider, think about what other people would do and try the opposite, right? Maybe some of these areas that seem pressured, seem really busy, are good places to start. Then don't forget about them, right? Go back to areas, and that's something we try to do it ourselves as anglers is, don't just hit one section of river once a day and, well, I didn't catch any fish. This water's no good. Now, go back, if you can, a couple times throughout the day, a couple times throughout the week or the season, whatever you're allowed to do. And if you can fish at different times of day, different levels of sunlight, your odds are you're going to probably find some more success and learn more about the river than if you just, well, I'm just going to hike as far away from everybody else and either I'm successful or I'm not. It's not a function of how far you go from the parking lot. Is everybody else doing the same thing? Can I try something maybe a little different than what everybody else is doing?
I would also say that it's similar. My answer would be similar to your first question about how do you define pressured water. You know, there's water where if you hike 100 yards, you're isolated. You're alone. You got it. And there's water, right, if you have miles, that you're still shoulder to shoulder. Then, you know, like the Kenai Peninsula, wherever you go, you're shoulder to shoulder relative to your, you know, your Alaska statement. But in, you know, high mountain, small water, if you do hike 100 yards, you might be fishing to a fish that's never seen an angler before, ever. And, but it's, as Nick said, I think that it's, the idea is don't just stand in the same place and do the same thing over and over and over again, especially if you're not getting the results you want. You know, move, look for different types of water, and don't gauge it necessarily by the metrics of how far or how long you've walked, but as you find success and experience success, notice what the water looks like, what the water is doing, how the fish are behaving, and store that in your mind and look to repeat that.
What role does timing play, like time of day or season, in beating the pressure?
I spend a lot of time. I'm really, really lucky to get to spend a lot of the summer in Montana. And like I said, the Madison is my home water. I almost never fish in the morning. I almost never fish. Pretty much, I'm going to fish the evening. I'm going to try to stagger it to where I'm like 3 or 4 hours behind the anglers, the big bulk of the anglers going down the water, whether it's drift fishing or whether they're wade fishing. I'm not in a rush to get there. And so I'm trying to fish odd hours. And Nick has fished with me a bunch, and we fish at night, you know, and then everyone thinks Western trout fishing, big Western expansive water, you are thinking mousing. Well, I mean, you can Euro nymph at night. There's 10,000 different techniques you can do and experience a bunch of success. And you essentially, if you stagger your timing, you'll have one of the most fished rivers in the world to yourself or to, you know, relative exclusivity. Nick, what do you think?
I think that's accurate. And I think being thoughtful and making notes on the time you fish it. And there's a reason that professional fishing guides are as successful and productive as they are, because they spend an inordinate amount of time on certain rivers throughout the course of the year. And I think that's something that's not easily obtainable for everybody, but something that should be appreciated is, if you really want to be successful, fish the same stretch of river as often, different times a day, you know, different water flows, different seasons, as often as you can to really understand and really start to learn a body of water. I think that gets forgotten about. Again, it's not very easy. Not everybody could do it, but, you know, we call it the 20-minute fish or a two-beer fish when we're hanging out together and fishing is, let's fish this smaller section, focus on the smaller section, different times a day, different seasons, different days of the week, different levels of boat and or wading traffic, and then you can really start to learn it and figure it out and maybe put a little less pressure and stress on yourself as an angler.
Yeah, a couple of situations that I remember. We were down fishing on the San Juan River, and we had our own boat. It was my father, my son, and I. And we went there, and the first day we got down there, and we ran into the traffic jam at the boat ramp. And we thought, why are all the guides down here all at the same time? This seems kind of ridiculous. And so the next day we thought, well, let's get out there like an hour earlier than everybody else, get our boat in and start fishing. Well, what little did we know is that the hatches didn't really get going until later in the morning. And I also found that out about the Arkansas River in Colorado, where Bill Edrington, in an interview I did with him, he said, yeah, go have a nice breakfast. Get an omelet, some hash browns, everything. Take your time, drink coffee, and get out there about 10 o'clock, and then the fishing will begin, you know. But stay into the dark for the larger fish. But, yeah, and what's funny is the next interview I'm doing is on mousing, Tommy Stacy up in Michigan, and he runs guide trips. He told me that he starts at 11 at night and finishes at 7 in the morning. So talking about getting away from the crowds, there you go. Yeah, and catch big fish, right? So if that's what you're after, So that was the other thing. In your book, you were talking. I'm sorry?
It's something to learn, too, on your own. And just because that's what everyone else tells you, we always say, well, just because this is how it's always been done or this is what you're told, you know, don't be afraid as an angler to, like you said, show up an hour earlier, stay an hour or two late, and figure it out.
Yeah.
for your own experience and what works? Because a lot of times there's always that history of, well, this is how you should do it. Well, you know, maybe you don't have to be the first one to the river. Maybe go have a breakfast and then ease into the morning type of deal, you know?
There's a reason river naps exist, right?
Yeah.
You know,
it's not gonna
just
say
you start early, but you can kill some of the worst time of the day. Well, you know, I mean, do a half-day float and take a river nap on a couch and put in, and you're fishing behind everybody, and those fish have had a few hours to relax. You know, it's,
yeah. Yeah, that was the other thing we found out on that trip, is that in the middle of the day down on the San Juan, it was hot, and the fishing just kind of turned off midday. And so we learned, we just went back to the motel where the air conditioning was and took a nap and then got out there in the evening. Yeah, so all those ways, right? But in your book, you talked a lot about seasons, too. You want to talk to that?
Yeah, and seasons are an important one. And if you have the time or the opportunity, and we know a lot of people want to fish the northern and southern Rockies in the summer, but there's a lot of great fishing to be had in the late fall. We were both just up with a group of people second week of November, and you know, by all accounts, we would assume it would be snowy and cold and nasty, and we turned out to have a couple 50, 60-degree days. So the ability to experiment and try different seasons will definitely pay off for anglers. And you might be surprised what you'll run into. And
depends on the year, too. Like this year is a dry and warm. I mean, I've only had one snow here, and I'm at 8,800 feet in elevation. You know, in the Rockies, and one snow that I had to shovel so far. And today I played pickleball in Boulder, and it was like 62 degrees, and we were all sweating out there. So, yeah, I mean, it's perfect right now in Colorado. I mean, even though it's January, you wouldn't know it.
We had to stay on a section of the Madison probably 4 years ago, and I don't mean to only talk about the Madison. I mean, we've been lucky enough to fish all over, but we had this epic day on the Madison in late November, and the fish behaved totally differently, which is discussed extensively throughout the book, is that, you know, don't get pigeonholed into expecting fish to do X, Y, or Z. You know, try to think outside the box and fish outside the box. But for about 2 or 3 hours in a snowstorm, if you threw a white streamer, you caught a fish damn near every cast. It was the best 2 or 3 hours of trout fishing I've ever had in my life. They were all cookie cutter 16 to 19 inch fish. And, you know, it's one of those stories where no one was there to share it with other than Nick and me, you know. It was
just that's enough.
Thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
fortunately, we were only fishing for ourselves and for fun. So it was worth it.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, for sure.
You would have never done that.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take another quick break here, gentlemen, and then we'll come right back and talk about some specific conditions that some of our listeners wrote in about. So here we go, and I'll be right back. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Nick Conklin and Collins Illich about fly fishing pressured waters. If you'd like to ask Nick or Collins a question, just go to our homepage and fill out that form, and we'll try to answer them on the show tonight. Let me just check real. Okay. Phil McCartney in Kentucky wrote, and he says, if I walk a mile or two away from the easy access areas, can I avoid encountering fish that are smarter than I am, even in pressured waters? 60 years ago, I hiked and fished a lake in Glacier Park just after ice went off the lake, and despite knowing nothing, I caught trout easily. Later that summer at the same lake, I was not too surprised that I caught nothing. How fast do trout wise up after ice out?
I mean, trout, can we make this a PG-13 style podcast?
Sure.
I mean, I would say, you know, imagine you're waking up with a bit of a headache after having a couple of beers the night before, and you need something greasy to eat, and you're not going to be that discriminating. That's a trout pepper. It's just going to go get whatever it can get. I remember being in Rocky Mountain National Park with my dad, who introduced me to fly fishing, and we saw a feeding fish, early season feeding fish, and I didn't have a fishing rod with me, which was rare, and I threw a Cheez-It to it. It ate it. I threw bread to it. It ate it. I threw a rock to it. It ate it and spit it out. You know, it's like a hungry fish is going to eat, period.
Yeah, yeah.
An ice fish is going to be a hungry fish. As those fish add protein, and, you know, they have a very narrow window to accumulate probably 80% of their annual protein intake. As they approach that 80%, that number is based on the Black Canyon statistics, and honestly, I don't know if that was ichthyologically based or just guide-based, but as they approach that 80% of their protein content for the year, they're going to get more selective, more selective, more selective, and more selective. Hmm. Also, as you, every time a fish is caught, every time a fish is shown a fly, every time a fish is fished for, it's going to learn. You know, getting smarter is probably not the right word, because these little things that swim around with pea-sized brains that outsmart us all the time, you know, I don't want to call them smart, but they seem to always outsmart us. They're learning all the time, just like we are. And I can't definitively say walk 2 miles on stream X, Y, or Z, and you're going to find virgin fish that are going to be eager to eat a fly. But I can say that generally, the further you get from access points and the closer you are to the end of a season and those fish are trying to fatten up, better said, the further you can get from an access point and the hungrier fish are, your success rate's going to go up regardless of skill level, anything like that. What do you think?
Sure, yeah. Were you asking me?
I would have really liked to have been on that lake with whoever wrote the question. That would have been a fun day of fishing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's just like getting a beaver and fly for 2 hours out of Anchorage, and you're going to find some real hungry, pretty dumb fish, you know, that'll eat about anything. You go onto a permit flat in Belize, and those fish can be damn smart, you know. So, yeah, everything plays a role, right? All the environmental factors, the season, the... But I think some fish are smarter than others, don't you think? Like... There's a lot of things smarter than a bluegill.
What I'm going to say is probably going to jade me for the rest of my fishing career. I don't think any fish I've ever caught is brilliant. But what I would say is that certain fish have different senses that are more hypersensitive. You know, I mean, like the lateral line of a snook is so obvious, and they're so sensitive to movement. Permit.
Yeah.
You just brought it boat flat. Because of the size of the lateral line, the size of their body, the way their body is physiologically constructed, they're sensitive to that. You know, there's a reason there's a reason IGFA says that you can't use scent and or any sort of live matter on a fly and it be IGFA compliant relative to fly fishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's taste, scent, feel. But I never felt like I caught a brilliant fish. What about you? Of course, I'm probably never going to catch a fish again in my life after saying
after
that.
You just jinxed yourself. No.
Yeah,
I know a lot of fish have outsmarted me.
Yeah, no doubt.
I've done too much to try to convince them that I'm smarter than them, and they'll look at my fly flying the river and say, I've seen this before. I know who this bozo is. Pass.
that's the guy who usually hooks himself.
Yeah.
Maybe it's more about them testing our skill set, right? You know, I mean, I've interviewed folks about that have done the snorkeling and underwater viewing, and they're, you know, they say like trout will take almost all kinds of things in their mouth in the river and spin them back out before we even knew they did it, you know.
No
so
doubt.
It wasn't about being smart. It was about our skill set and not getting hooked up, not recognizing that they took, our fly in their mouth. So, yeah, I think for me, it's my skill set. That's the problem.
If I may, one more second, I apologize. But you're talking about a core philosophy for how I fish. And I think how Nick has fished with me and then how we've grown as angler couple, whatever, for lack of a better word. But, like, you're only compelled to answer to yourself when you go fishing. And, like, what challenge do you want to achieve? Do you only want to catch a fish on a dry fly? Do you just want to catch fish? Do you only want to catch a brown trout? Whatever it is, you know, you're only compelled to answer to yourself. And it's you versus that one little living thing. And you define success or failure.
That's true. That's right. Yep. Well, let's see if we can answer some of our listeners' questions here. Gary Cook in Denver, Colorado. And I don't know if you guys have fished the South Platte or not, but regardless, you can still answer this question because it apply it other places. On a river like the South Platte below Cheeseman Dam, it looks like the coming months will be a combination of low water, less than 100 CFS, crowds, and low temps and snowpack. Any recommendations around that specific set of factors?
I mean, everyone's going to deal with similar factors. Usually spend a week or two, and a former guest of yours, Jason Randall, we do a school up there every year, and we get that question often. Typically, our schools are more towards the spring, early summer, and similar conditions, right? Low water, high sun, and I'd say it's where you need to start thinking a little bit differently as an angler. Is it worth it necessarily to fish it? Yes, I know everyone wants to fish and be on the water and go beat it up and try to catch fish, but some of what we try to help people think about is this right for the resource? Because everyone could go out there and try to catch fish in this low water scenario and really pressure them, really stress the fish, stress the fishery. But are we better off maybe thinking, let's hold off now till there's some better snowpack, till there's some runoff? And is it going to be better in a couple weeks, couple months, couple years, instead of trying to find some instant gratification? And I know that's a hard concept for a lot of us with limited time or anglers that just can't get out more than once or twice a year. But we need to start thinking at a little bit longer term, a little bit deeper of how we approach this water, and not just, am I going to find success now and then down the road I'll just have to figure it out again, or do I maybe take a step back, not fish it right now, in the hopes that once the water comes up, once the conditions get better, everyone will find more success and have an opportunity to fish it, and the fish will be healthy.
But I think that it's a particularly pertinent question for what's going on right now, right? Like, think about it from the fishing perspective, and then think about it from, not to make fly fishing even more bougie, but think about it from the skier perspective. Like, right, if there wasn't enough snow on the mountain for you to safely ski, would you go ski? You know, you're just going to ski into rocks and destroy your skis and not have a good time. Like, the fish need the same protection, and that just is what it is. Like, unless you don't care, and I don't mean to be insensitive to each individual angler, because Nick did correctly point out that, you know, not everybody gets as much time on the water as everyone else, but if the fish mortality rate's going to go through the roof, like, especially a place like Cheeseman Canyon, is that the place to spend your time? And if it is, if that's where you want to do, what I would do is I would find any moving water and I would fish it as hard as I could. And I would fish very, very small, very, very tight, in the fastest water I could find.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about the South Platte below Cheeseman is this fishery, for those of you out there that have not fished it, is very accessible from Denver metropolitan area. So not only do we have that as an issue for pressure, but people that come in to do business in Denver, it's a really close place to get away and do some fishing, and that might be the only opportunity that person has as well. So that fishery has become a really tough one because of its accessibility to a major metropolitan area. Unlike Madison, but the Madison, you've got a lot of summer travelers that are in that whole area to give it pressure.
There's a bridge by where I stay, and you can see about 3/4 of a mile upstream and 1/2 mile downstream. And Nick and I were there in July a couple of years ago, and we counted 21 boats upstream and 18 boats downstream. So if you call that 1.5 miles, just conservatively, let's say my binocular rangefinder was off a little bit, but you're talking about 40 boats essentially in 1.5 miles.
Yeah.
And that's likely at two anglers per boat, not counting any weight anglers in the area. And people are still catching trophy fish every day. But, which is brought up in the book extensively, hoot owl, Montana does a good job protecting the resource relative to oxygen level in the water and survivability
of
fish. So,
well, let's hit Jeff Arburn's from New Mexico question. He says, I'm interested in your observations about how fish respond to increased pressure. One of the streams occupied with native cutthroat trout that I fish frequently was highlighted in a fly fishing magazine a few years ago, and the angling pressure increased significantly. The stream has sections with beautiful pools and meanders along with stretches of much shallower riffles. The obvious pools get covered by everyone that stops to fish, and I've definitely observed more and larger fish that would be expected that have moved into more marginal habitat that is less attractive to anglers. So he's asking for your observations on what he's observed.
So relative to the comment or the question, the specific part of the question, the article, yes, there's more, and obviously there's more media opportunities, there's more spotlight on a lot of our fisheries, but as anglers, we still have to get the job done, right? Just because there's a good article, and I come from the magazine world prior to the rod manufacturing world, so I get the importance of talking about different rivers, different bodies of water, but us as anglers, we still have to get the job done, and I think where anglers can really take a step forward from everyone else, and that's maybe not the best way to say it, but where anglers can really improve and step above, go above and beyond, is what they do in their preparation.
Their own angling skill set.
They can go beyond just, all right, now there's a lot of people fishing, right? You referenced the San Juan. How often does that river get fished? But the really productive, really proficient, effective anglers have spent a little bit more time focusing on themselves, getting their skills up to speed, up to par, and that's where you find that success. So I hope people don't think just because this magazine, this blog, this TV show, this YouTuber talks about a body of river that there's just going to be a bunch of people flooded to it and you're not going to find success. There's ways to find success if you just focus in on your own skills and build that.
And I think Nick said something there that I'd like to just truncate down real quickly if that's okay. And that's, you can always improve your own skill set. And we talked about it a minute ago. You only fish for yourself, but just get better. Keep getting better. Keep improving your own skill set. And don't worry about any of the outside noise. Enjoy it, you know. The fact that you have noticed that those fish have moved from one spot to another spot speaks to your skill. Most anglers would not have noticed that. You did. Like, you're starting to figure it out. There's always secondary and tertiary points and seams, and as fish experience pressure and get moved, whether it is it doesn't matter, as they are forced out, whether an osprey builds a nest over them, going to that environmental pressure, or whether it's angling pressure, and they move to a different section of the river, your ability to diagnose that and dissect the river makes you a much higher skilled angler than 99% of the anglers out there. So you should just be proud you wrote the question.
Great question from Jeff there in New Mexico.
Yeah, there you go.
Don't send him. He doesn't need it.
Brad Holm in San Diego says, if you come across a run where you saw another angler fishing, how long should you wait to fish that run? Does the season, water temperature, water clarity, water speed play a role in the length of time?
Yes, is the answer to all of those questions.
that's too easy now. Come on.
There's absolutely not going to be a defined, you know, wait 57 minutes. It's not a turkey on Thanksgiving, you know. Did he catch any fish? Did he catch a bunch of fish? Did he walk through what you think is going to be the two or three best parts of that run to fish after he caught no fish? And then is the water temperature 70 degrees? If the water temperature is 70 degrees, the mortality rate on salmonoid is going to be astronomically high. So give it even more time. If the water temperature is good, if there's a hatch happening and it's 10 minutes after that guy left, I'd go right in there and I'd feel really confident about it. But every one of those is a variable, right? And so let's go through it. Water temperature. If it's an ideal water temperature, call it 50 degrees to 65 degrees, I'm going to fish a lot faster behind them than I would if it got any higher or any colder than that. Water clarity? That's a really difficult question, but if the water is nasty and murky, I'm going to be even less sensitive to how long the time has passed since he fished it, because I'm going to believe that those fish probably didn't even see a fly. If the water is gin clear, we're talking New Zealand, we're talking Silver Creek in Idaho, pick a place. If it's gin clear, I'm going to wait longer and longer and longer to go behind him. The water speed, the faster it is, the less sensitive I'm going to be to how long he's passed through that water. If it's really still, and still water fish is totally different, so that's not that. If it's really slow, I'm going to be more sensitive to how long it's been versus if it's fast, faster moving, blah, 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 blah. Every one of those is a variable. And if Nick and I could answer that question in a black and white manner, we wouldn't need to write a book. We would have an app, and people would put information in, and we would make a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
Because
the one thing that I see that's left out of here is the skill set of the angler. I mean, I fished a hole and not caught anything, and my son comes behind me and catches a fish. Wasn't anything wrong with the hole. Again, we're back to my skill set, right? But that is a variable as well, right?
I was on the Skeena River fishing a bend, and I watched three anglers go through it, and nobody caught anything. And they were all using, like, Skagit style, call it 12.5 to 13-foot, 3-inch style, two-handed rods, heavy rigs. And an angler walked behind them with like a 10.5-foot switch rod. And I'm not saying I could have done this, but he caught three steelhead on about a half a river mile behind these guys. And it was within 30 minutes. And I watched the whole thing happen. And he knew exactly how to cast, where to cast, what to do.
Yeah.
And just smoked them because of his skill set.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, this goes back to the basics, like you guys talked about at the beginning. Yeah. Al Moore, Atlanta, Georgia. Would your strategy change if you were fishing a stream that held stocked trout, either recently stocked or acclimated, instead of wild fish? Several southeastern states have fall to spring delayed harvest programs where designated streams are stocked periodically and no harvest is allowed.
I wouldn't say the strategy would change, and I think Al's question tags into Brad's and Jeff's very well. So some of it's skill set of the angler, some of it's when and how you approach it. I think there's an element, too, to approaching it more than once. I feel a lot of anglers see somebody fishing a section of water, fishing it where they found the most success, right? It's probably fishing the pool, probably fishing something that seems like obvious water. Then they just keep moving up or downstream, and they never come back to it. So whether it's stocked fish like this or native fish, like the other gentleman have asked questions about, is you come back throughout the day or the course of a couple days. And I think that's an element that sets a lot of people apart, is just because you fish it through once or one or two other people, you've seen one or two other people fish it, I think there's a lack of returning to it at different times of the day, different, you know, different positions of the sun, different water levels, different water temperatures, that regardless of if they're stocked or not, is an element for success that gets forgotten about.
I agree with Nick, and it's kind of we're not trying to just say that there's undefinable variables associated with questions, but there's a lot of undefined variables associated with that question. And how fast do fish get conditioned? Probably depends on how many skilled anglers fish for them, how often they get caught, how often they get released, how much food is in their ecosystem. I would say that I wouldn't worry about stocked trout on an annually stocked trout getting terribly conditioned. And if I was worried about them getting terribly conditioned, my first reaction would be to fish something big and flashy, which would be contrarian to almost everything written in the book. I think that they would be used to eating something small and pellety, like a hare's ear fly. And I would just want to get in front of them. I would want to be really, really aggressive. But there's a lot of speculation in that statement. And I'm sorry, I can't make that a black and white statement.
Yeah, well, You know, a lot of those stocking programs are there for put and take, right? So those fish might not be there all that long to get acclimated, right?
Correct.
Yeah, they might have a hard time getting their PhD when it's put and take kind of situations. So.
Agreed.
Yeah. There's a question. How important is stealth compared to presentation on crowded rivers?
So there are a lot of opinions on this, and I do have a black and white opinion on this. I think the number one most important thing to do when you are fishing, and this is cross species, cross water bodies, is to be fishing where fish are. So the first thing to do is find fish. The second thing to do is to not let the fish know you're there. The third thing to do is to fish in the correct portion of the water column. The fourth thing to do is to fish the right size. The fifth thing to do is to fish the right thing. And those are written in order of importance for me. So stealth is very, very high. I do not want a fish to know I'm there, but it's way more important to me. Even if I have to make a bunch of noise, whether it's with my boat or with wading, I care more about fishing where I think a fish is, where I'm confident that a fish is, than being totally stealthy. But stealth is number two. Then I care about my flies. I mean, I've got Nick and I, we have everyone. Like, how many, we love, the reason we fly fish mostly is because we like to buy flies, right? We got all these fly boxes full of beautiful flies, and I fish the same like six flies all the time. And you can catch fish on those in any condition, any circumstance, as long as you're fishing the right water, the right depth, and then right the next step after that would be the fish doesn't know you're there. What do you think?
I think that's a good way to separate it. I'd rather have my fly again in the right zone. And I can, and any angler, not just myself, any angler can improve their stealthiness, right? Be more thoughtful about how your body moves, how you move. But if you can get the fly to the right zone, regardless of the size, shape, color, whatever it is, you're probably going to find success. And then you can kind of step back and work on your body movements, become stealthier. Then if the bite turns off or it gets finicky, really refine your fly. But work in that depth, that presentation first, and then work back on some of those other things, I think
I
you'll
think
find
that's
more
really well
success.
said, the work back from there. Find the fish and work back. And that's where you go from catching a dozen fish a day to catching 100 fish a day. As you start at point one and just keep circling back and going back down. And we talked about that earlier. I don't remember which question it was, but it was once you, I think it was the prep water where the fish were moving into the secondary and tertiary channels. You know, once you know that secret, then you can really start to smoke them if that's what you want to do.
What about a question here was how do you decide between changing flies versus changing tactics? That kind of, you know, plays into what we're just talking about here.
You know, I would yield less towards changing flies and more towards being able to adapt to different techniques. Whether you're a nymphing, throwing a dry fly, throwing streamers on a single hand or a two-handed rod, I think there's a lot to be learned if you can really hone those skills and techniques so you can adapt on the conditions versus constantly changing flies. Again, we all have a lot of great friends that are great fly tiers and love to support the fly tying industry, love to fill boxes, but at the end of the day, if you could focus on a couple flies, I feel like you'll find more success. You can just get really sharp on different techniques and presenting the fly a different way each time. The fly may not even change, right? But focus on techniques and building those skills, then you can experiment more on different flies and colors and shades and all that.
And I'm a big proponent of confidence when you fish. You know, and if you're fishing a spring creek, not to keep patting my buddy on the back, but he is an absolutely excellent two-handed caster, and his particular passion is swinging flies. Well, that's not going to be useful on a spring creek, right? But if you can figure out what makes you confident in body water X, Y, and Z, and stick to, I'm a better angler when I'm confident, period. Doesn't matter. And then you and I spoke about my mother-in-law earlier today, just anecdotally, but she only dry fly fishes, and she dry fly fishes when it makes zero sense to dry fly fish on very heavily fished water. And she's amazingly successful because she carries that confidence with her. So I would say, and there's a tweak to this, and I don't mean to take up too much time because I know we're getting closer to the end, but you need to enjoy how you're fishing. Going back to that, it's your time, it's your leisure time, leisure money, and you need to have confidence in how you're fishing. And if you're doing those two things on a designated body of water, kind of regardless of how many fish you catch, you'll probably catch more fish, and you're going to walk home or going to walk to your truck with your buddy and be like, man, that was a fun day, versus constantly retying, constantly cussing, being like, man, I can't figure this out. I just hooked myself in the back of my neck because I was throwing a streamer that I'm not comfortable throwing, you know, 10,000 different problems. Then you're just creating stress in your life, and stress is going to make you a less successful angler, and it's going to kill your enjoyment on the water.
Yeah, a few years ago, I ran into another fly fisher in the parking lot close by where I live here, and I'm putting on my 20-pound fly vest, you know, with all these fly boxes in it and stuff, right? And he's there, and he pulls out, and he's looking in his, he's got like an Altoid box, okay? And all his flies are in that one Altoid box, and that's all he was carrying besides, you know, the other tools you have to have. But we were talking, he goes, yeah, I never need any more than these flies, you know? I mean, I always catch fish with these flies, and, you know, guess what? I got rid of that 20-pound vest. Now I'm down to one fly box. But, well, you know, it was...
Go ahead.
Yeah? Well, I was going to say it was a lesson learned. And also, I go back to, hey, when all else fails, guess what I catch a lot of fish on? Good old pheasant tail. Hare's ear. Well, I've been fishing those flies since I was 13 years old. And they still work, you know? And what can you say?
I would be willing to bet everyone still listening has read A River Runs Through It, and you morphed from Paul McLean to Norman McLean in the last chapter of A River Runs Through It by dumping your fly vest and switching to a simple hat band worth of flies, you know?
Yeah. Well, tell us about, there are some questions. Let's see, Jim Seben says, is it better to add more flies as droppers when fishing for small trout? I usually fish in current with two or three small droppers off a larger pattern, such as a stonefly with no indicator. Since I do this continually, I don't know if it's better or worse.
Sounds like Jim spent some time fishing in Colorado with the multiple fly situation. So thanks.
Or breaking some laws.
Or breaking laws.
Hopefully not breaking some laws.
Poignant question there, Jim. And, you know, I'll reference back to a good friend and an author and a former guest of yours, Jason Randall, who talks a lot about how currents are so vastly different. And to me, because I'm just a simple fly angler, I'd rather fish less flies and understand how they move in the different currents than have several flies that could be moving differently based off current speed. And if you're not finding a ton of success with a lot of flies, and I'll do this often, even in rivers I've either fished a lot or I'm very new to, is I'll run through a section of river I think is attractive with one fly before I get a feel down, and then I may add a second one or a third one if, you know, laws permit that. But I'd be cautious of fishing too many flies, one, because the current's moving, two, because it just adds for an opportunity for failure or for tangles, and then we go back to what we were saying earlier where you're retying, you're re-rigging, and you're just missing fishing opportunities. So I get some rivers you need to have, you know, multiple contact points in terms of flies, but I don't always know, most anglers, we don't always know what that current, how that water's moving underneath the surface, right? And I feel like a lot of times we think, let's put a few more flies on there, increase our chance of success, and those flies may be moving at different speeds. And as you said earlier, like a fish may grab that fly and we don't notice it on the fly on the surface or on that indicator, and we've just missed something, right? We screwed up. So
I would add just a little bit to that. I think I agree completely with Nick. I think that overcomplicating is probably not going to help your success rate. But reading your question, Jim, it's clear that you're a very skilled angler. But My only comment would be, and since I do this continually, I don't know if it's better or worse. Though we just said, you know, fish what your confidence baits are and how you are confident in fishing, I would say, especially if you're fishing the same water over and over and over again, I would vary it up a little bit. You have the opportunity to learn, I mean, because you have a fixed variable. I'm fishing this run. Now I fished it with three droppers off of a, you know, stonefly. Now I fished it with two. Now I fished it with one. Now I just fished three droppers, no stonefly, tight lining. I read Jason Randall's book, and I got better at just straight tight lining. I would use that as an opportunity to figure it out. I think that a little bit of change from a perspective like that would probably give you some – it may not yield the results you want, but it will yield the answer you want.
Okay, a couple of questions. I want you guys to answer these quickly, and then we'll have one final question because we're running out of time here. Jason Stacy in Kentucky, do you find that you need to downsize your flies for pressured water?
Yes. Okay. And no.
Gary.
We'll explain why we have two different.
Well, mine, yes. Go, Nick.
Mine is no, because that's the common idea is smaller, more pressured water. Let's downsize it. To me, maybe think outside the box a little bit. And these fish continue to see small flies. Let me throw a big fly and see if I can't piss this fish off. So,
or if you're strictly a dry fly fisherwoman, you fish dries.
Right. Yeah, or just dry fish, big fry. Try to tick it off or give it something really enticing to make it worth the calorie energy burn to go up and get it.
Yeah, there you go. Gary Kaufman in North Carolina, do you change leader tippet for pressured waters? And if so, what do you recommend?
I generally don't. Honestly, and I know that that seems counterintuitive, but I fish pretty light tippet to begin with. I'm a very dedicated fluorocarbon angler, and I know that not everyone is. So that's a whole other argument that we don't have time for. But I fish a lot of 5X, 6X, 7X already, and there's not a lot that I can do to go lighter. I would have to be like big dry fly fishing and or streamer fishing to not be fishing 5X or lighter.
Okay. I do have one other question that snuck in here online. And since you're, you know, Collins, you're a guide, maybe you can address this. It's a Jeffrey, he's in Denver. I was fishing a run on the Blue River, that's in Colorado here, and had a guy place three inexperienced family members encircling me, one in front, one behind, and one between me and the bank. How should someone manage that type of situation? The guide was quite nasty with an attitude that he was earning money and I was in his favorite hole.
Okay. You said we're PG-13, right?
Yeah.
So that guy's an a-hole. I won't say the word. he doesn't own the water. Crowding an angler like that is totally unacceptable. And if the guide was particularly rude, I would take a picture and I would send it to a fish and game department because, like, putting somebody upstream and downstream of you, I mean, there's high-holing an angler and then there's surrounding an angler. That is totally unacceptable. There's no element of fishing that would say that that is an appropriate way to approach a river. And what I personally would do, I probably would take a picture of him. I probably would do nothing with it, but I would take the picture as I walked away, and I would go find new water. And
get out of there.
So you're earning a living. That doesn't mean, I mean, if I don't make a rent payment at my warehouse where my fishing rods are stored, my landlord doesn't care that I'm earning a living there, right? Like, it's just... reality, you know, like it's just, that's a totally unacceptable thing. And
yeah,
the last portion of that answer is I can almost guarantee you, and I'm going to make this almost R-rated for a second. I apologize, Roger. I can almost guarantee you that that guy will be run out of the fishing industry because one of the cool parts about the fishing industry is that there are not a lot of assholes. They get identified pretty quickly and they get pushed out and they should. And that guy likely will not have a career in the fishing industry.
I guess the other thing you could do is say, hey, what shop do you work out of?
And
make a phone call.
And learning, right? Everyone's learning, and maybe it's an opportunity where that specific guy needs to learn, and there's some calm, metered communication that needs to occur, and maybe it's not the responsibility of the angler to do it because you don't want to get into something on the river. But
that guy clearly lacks maturity and experience.
Yeah. I learned, somebody told me this years ago, and it was like, well, how close should you be fishing to another person? And this, I don't know if it was a guide or somebody older than me, and he said, well, the way I see it is, if I can see what color line he's using, I'm too close. And that was, I've kind of used that as my guide over the years. But okay, one final question here. This is a tough one. With the pressure continuing to get stronger, what changes do you see coming in the next 20 years that will change the way we fish today or our access to the fisheries?
I don't think that there's going to be, if I expected anything to be driven by government, I would expect those changes to be things like, now I'm talking only on public water, okay? I think that you would see more things like hoot owl, and that might not, where hoot owl is based on water temperature, it might be based on, you know, hey, if you have a, if you have an odd number pin on your license, you get to fish hours X, Y, and Z. If you have an even number pin on your license, you get to fish, you know, X, Y, and Z. I don't think that you're going to see a massive amount of exclusion. I think it's going to be an inclusion-based deal. But what do you think? Nick's looking at me like, can't wait to talk, so go.
And I think that the onus falls on us as anglers is we need to learn about our waters. We need to care about it, but we need to be participatory, right? We need to pay attention to public land access. We all need to get involved with things like BHA, right, backcountry hunters and anglers, and talk to our legislators. I know it seems silly to write letters and call somebody on the phone, but if we want to continue the great resource that we have and keep it open to everyone, not just people with money, deep pockets that could buy sections of the river, we all have to take it on ourselves to make the effort to protect the waters, the rivers we care about, and just pay attention and be participatory, be active in protecting those.
Yeah, the thing that I'm concerned about, and this is because of my whitewater rafting experience, is on most of the popular whitewater rafting runs through these rivers, most 80 to 90% of the permits ish, and first of all, you have to have a permit to run it, okay, which we don't have to have nowadays for fishing, but 80, 90% of it is commercial outfitters that are running. Okay, so that's, you know, like Collins, you're a guide, you're a commercial outfitter. And then the rest is for the public to do their own trips. If you want to row your own boat, you know, I rode my raft down, you know, 21 days down the Grand Canyon on a private trip. We waited 12 years to get the permit. 12 years to get the permit to do that. We could have gone next week on a commercial trip. So this is what worries me about fishing, is that it will get to that point where their government's going to say only 10 boats on the Madison per day. That's it. And you got to get I have to put in a lottery to get a permit. And you guys, it sounds like you don't see that's coming. To me, that's very realistic.
There's discussion. Yeah. And there's discussion on specifically the Madison about that. And I got to be really careful what I say because I don't want my tires slashed on my truck this summer. But it's I mean, it is. I can tell you, 40 boats on that mile and a half section that we were talking about earlier. That's not good for the fishery. I don't think it's going to be a boat count like you're discussing for the Grand Canyon. And sometime you and I are going to have to chat. I got a great, great fishing story on that stretch of water, but believe it or not, it's going to be a water discussion. And what does the CFS equate to relative to healthy fishery for
this specific body of water, and then the metric of how do you decide who gets that slot, mm-hmm. that could be the variation that you're talking about relative to fishery, but I think we're a long way from that, and I think there's a lot of things we can do to prevent that from happening, both industry professionals like ourselves,
mm-hmm.
Recreational anglers, fishery biologists, fishery management teams. I mean, there's a lot that would have to, relying on government here and knock on wood, but there's a lot that would have to fall apart before we got to that threshold, I think.
Hmm. Well, you guys are in the thick of it, you know.
Clearly, you're glass half empty about this, huh?
Well, no, well, because, you know, with the river running situation, the lottery system and those conditions have been around for 30, 40 years. That's not something new. So, and I hear you too, like when you say water conditions, that's another limiting factor that could play into it of where, okay, now we kind of do it on our own good judgment, right? The hoot owl situation, I mean, it's kind of dependent on us to take control of that, but down the road, it could be fines and stuff. But then again, we might not have any people to administer the fines, considering the employment situation in the forestry service and stuff like that, the fisheries thing. So, yeah, I don't know. I just bring it up. You say it's glass. I used to go up to Rocky Mountain National Park or other places here in the Rockies to go backpacking when I was 20 years old, and we just went and we picked a spot and we set up. Now I have to start and the same thing with car camping grounds. You have to start reserving camping spots in January for next June. Otherwise, you won't have one. So I don't think I'm glass half empty. I think it's more realistic. And I think I agree with you that I think it's something that we have to fight for to be able to maintain access to things. But that's just my take. I don't know.
Can I have a 30-second rebuttal real quickly?
Sure, sure.
I think that the greatest gift we've been given is the National Park Service. And that's going to protect a lot. The public lands, and that obviously my perspective is skewed to the west, and that's different in the east, right? And that's different in Texas, for that matter, right? Because of public land versus private land. But mm-hmm. I believe usage is good. Usage protects the resource, even though it seems counterintuitive, and we need the usage so that the land's not exploited, so the resource isn't exploited on a much larger scale than what the sport angler, the recreational camper, the recreational hiker would ever do to the resource. So I'm pro usage, but I do think mm-hmm. that there definitely has to be steps. I don't think, I'm 45, like I said, I don't think in my lifetime I'm going to see large scale, you know, boats aren't allowed. There's a lottery for 10 boats on this river, X, Y, Z, in name a river out west. But that's my gut. That's what I feel. And I hope to God I'm right.
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope so too. And a lot of what I was talking about too is to protect the resource. Okay. In other words, the reason only so many rafts or boats go down these rivers is because you have to protect the resource. Yeah. If it was bumper-to-bumper boats, it wouldn't be the same experience. Yeah.
It depends who's defining how you protect the resource.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be the right educated human deciding that, right? Because it's certainly easy to say, we're only going to let 12 anglers fish from Windy Point to town on the Madison every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's 12 commercial boats, no other boats launch. Everyone else can be a wade angler. Like, that doesn't protect the resource. So it depends who's deciding who is protecting the resource. And that goes back to a comment I made earlier when I knocked on wood and said, shit, it's government. We're counting on government here. And that's
that's a more complex discussion.
It's that is. Well, let's leave it there. We've gone way over time, but it's been fun talking about this stuff. And it's important. It's important stuff to talk about. And I hope your predictions are true. And for my grandchildren, I really hope they're true. So, all right. Well, listen, we got to wrap it up here, but stick with me because we're going to give away 1-year membership to Fly Fishers International, 1-year membership to Trout Unlimited, and also giving away a copy of Nick and Colin's book, Fly Fishing Pressured Waters, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So hang tight, and we'll do that in just a minute. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit BTT.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's BTT.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. So if you didn't register for tonight's show, by now it's too late. But do so for our next show, because you don't want to miss out on potentially winning one of these great prizes. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. The first thing we'll be giving away is a membership to Fly Fishers International. And if you aren't a member yet, be sure to go check them out. Fly Fishers International is a great organization to be part of and support. And it's our winner for that is David Maynard in South Dakota. So congrats, David, on winning that membership to Fly Fishers International. And now we're going to give away 1-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And to learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to TU.org. And another great organization to support. And both these organizations do a lot for what we were talking about tonight in protecting the waters and fisheries that we all enjoy. So if you don't win, go join them anyway. Our winner for that is Brad Holm in California. Brad Holm. So congratulations, Brad. So now for tonight's question. And this is to win a copy of Nick and Colin's book, Fly Fishing Pressured Waters. And we've got other questions coming in. Too late, guys, too late. So to do this, you have to fill out the form on our homepage, same form that you could ask questions in during the show. And you have to submit your answer along with your name and location. And the first person that gets the answer to the question correct will win a copy of Nick and Colin's book, Fly Fishing Pressured Waters. So the question is, and I'm sorry, gentlemen, I don't know who voiced this, but I think it was a 7-step analysis of what to do first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and able to catch a fish. And what was the first thing that was the most important thing if you want to go catch a fish in pressured waters? Or anyway, what's the most important thing that you should do first? And I hope that was clear enough. So now, Nick and Collins, it's a slight delay before they hear the question, and then they have to type their answer. Well, I don't think this is it, but I'll throw this out there, guys. Look at the water. Observe the water. These are two answers coming in. Any comment on those two? Because I got another one that I think is closer here. How about fish where fish are?
Yeah,
that's the one I was thinking of, is fish where the fish are first, and then everything else is secondary. And who was that? Colin, was that you, or was that Nick that stepped us through that?
I walked y'all through that, but it's not an original idea. So
But it's if there's no fish there, everything else is mute, right? I mean, doesn't make any difference, right? So that's Charles Card in Dutch John City. Utah, I believe. Yeah, Dutch Town
Green
City's
River.
in Utah, right? Yeah, Green River up there, Charles Card. He might even be a guide. I think he's a guide up there, Charles. Anyway, Charles, hey, you just won this wonderful book, Fly Fishing Pressured Waters. So, Charles, I need you to send me, and you can do it in the same box that you just answered the question, send me your shipping address so I can get out over to Stackpole and they'll ship the book out to you. I've got your name. I've got your email address here. I just need your shipping address and put in your phone number there, too, in case there's any problems in getting that book to you. So anyway, thanks for playing, everybody, tonight. I know we had another correct answer after that, third correct answer. So a lot of, but Charles was first, so that's the criteria. Nick and Collins, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. It was a pleasure to talk. I know things got a little testy there at the end, but I think it's all important stuff to talk about, and I'm glad it was you two guys that I got to talk to you about. So thanks for sharing your experience and knowledge, and maybe I'll have you guys back again, talk about some other fishing that you guys do. So I would look forward to doing that sometime.
We'd be happy to be back and appreciate your time. And thank you to everyone that listened in and or sent in questions.
Well, hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look in the link in the top line menu. In the archive, you're going to find past shows, over 425 shows, which you can search by keyword phrase, like trout, tarpon, Madison River, and so forth. So go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you find out there. Our next broadcast will be on January 21st, 7 p.m., 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, I'll interview Tommy Lynch, and our show will be After Dark Predators, Fly Fishing with Mouse Patterns for Trophy Brown Trout. When the sun goes down, big trout come out to hunt, and few flies trigger more violent takes than a well-fished mouse. In this episode, Michigan guide Tommy Lynch breaks down the art and science of fly fishing with mouse patterns. We cover mouse fly design, rods and lines, presentation tactics, reading water at night, and how to safely fish after dark. If you want to target your biggest trout on purpose, this episode delivers the playbook. So be sure to add this upcoming show to your calendar. Just click on the Add to Calendar link below Tommy's photo on our homepage, and you'll be all set. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula, Skagit Tactics, The Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future live broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing. Well,